It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
This was without doubt the most critical test yet of the U.S. missile defense system, with the Pentagon under huge pressure to deliver a successful strike and thus send a powerful message to North Korea or any other nation that might target the United States. The launch of the ground-based interceptor missile was spectacular and deadly serious, testing the first line of U.S. defense should North Korea fire a nuclear weapon at an American city, a capability the Pentagon believes Pyongyang will soon have.
In my view, it's a matter of time.
Vice Admiral James Searing is the director of the Missile Defense Agency and sat for a rare and exclusive interview with Fox News ahead of the test, in which the U.S. is simulating a North Korean attack by launching an unarmed intercontinental ballistic missile from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean and aiming to take it down with the interceptor launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California.
It's very difficult. We're talking about intercepting in space at hundreds of miles of altitude with closing velocities of thousands of miles per hour. It's hitting a bullet with a bullet. I'm very confident through tactics and procedures that this system can and will defend the homeland if attacked.
Fox News was also given exclusive access to the 49th Missile Defense Battalion at Fort Greely, Alaska, where 32 of the U.S. total of 36 interceptors are based in these silos. Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Brower is the commanding officer.
You've got a nuclear weapon fired heading for L.A. How many of these do you fire to take it down?
So the tactics, techniques, and procedures, those are classified, but I'll say we fire more than one. If we're talking about a nuclear warhead headed to L.A., we want to make sure that we get it.
When we're all watching the news and seeing North Korea preparing for a test, you guys are at a very different level here.
Absolutely. We are ready to fight tonight.
It's a report last night from Jonathan Hunt, and it's a partial report from Special Report, but the point is this. Never in my lifetime have we actually been within the range of some rogue state or would-be enemy who actually wants to launch a nuclear weapon on our shores. And yet it's part of the nightly news. It's kind of casual conversation. And it's like we're watching some fantasy about how our guys shoot down, you know, a potential missile. And so I think everyone thinks, so, well, we're okay, we're safe. Well, thank God for technology. Thank God for Ronald Reagan, who envisioned this and was fought tooth and nail by the Democrats, mocked. I remember this well. They said he was crazy because he talked about Star Wars defense. Ha, ha, ha. Wouldn't that be funny? Trying to do something up in space, or, you know, what he had in mind might not have been exactly this. It was an idea, and it was a fantastical idea at the time that you could shoot down things in space using technology in this way. But that's exactly what happened. And thank God for our military. Thank God for technology. What would we do without it? But I think the point is this. We are in grave danger, and yet we go about our daily lives. And certainly the press goes about their daily life. And as a matter of fact, while this is possible, it's possible that they might hit Seattle. Oh, and by the way, I just read a report a few days ago that Washington State prohibits any kind of preparation for a nuclear attack. They have on the books preparations for all kinds of other disasters, but the politicians there feel like it's kind of the same logic as, you know, allowing jihadists in and being friendly to them, and somehow you're going to stop the attacks. You don't want to give the wrong signal by preparing for a nuclear attack. So they're not prepared, and they proudly say so. Hawaii, meanwhile, is getting ready. These are states. These are American citizens we're talking about. And North Korea is openly boasting, talking, threatening to give us some sort of a surprise soon. So This is something that we must factor in. And even if our emotions don't respond, it's hard to believe or hard to fathom. Our minds must take us to the place where we understand that we don't know what tomorrow might bring. We didn't ever know, but certainly we don't know it now. But what's the press talking about? Well, they're still a little preoccupied. Let's go to cut one.
It was as sudden as it was heated. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer's first on-camera briefing in over 2 weeks quickly unraveled today after he was asked about the president's tweet on fake news. Mr. Trump writing, Russian officials must be laughing at the U.S. and how a lame excuse for why the Democrats lost the election has taken over the fake news. Asked today to give an example of that, Mr. Spicer said this.
Friday, the president was having a great discussion at the G7, and someone from the BBC and ultimately an incoming reporter from the New York Times retweeted that the president was being rude by disrespecting the Italian prime minister.
But after some reporters said that wasn't so much of a big deal, the press secretary shot back.
The reason that the president is frustrated is because there's a perpetuation of false narratives, a use of unnamed sources over and over again about things that are happening that don't ultimately happen, and I think that is troubling.
The contentious briefing coming on a day when the White House's communications director, Mike Dubke, confirmed he's resigned after just 3 months on the job. Dubke writing, the reasons for my departure are personal, but it has been my great honor to serve President Trump and this administration. Dubke's decision to leave is not unprecedented. In fact, President Obama's first communication director, Ellen Moran, also left the post after 3 months on the job before landing over at Commerce. His departure seemed to confirm the president's frustration that his shop's been unable to slow stories suggesting ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, none of which have been proven true.
They've really been kind of a Spartan crowd at the White House. They need to beef it up, and they need to bring in some talent who are dedicated to the president's agenda.
Talent like that of Mr. Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, who's rumored to be under consideration to join a retooled White House war room.
The president has always surrounded himself with people who are able to work together and in a collaborative fashion are able to deal with the news of the day, but also think more long-term and strategically.
All right, that's Kellyanne Conway. You recognize her voice. But the first part of that, the point I was trying to make was while North Korea threatens to drop a nuclear, send a missile with a nuclear warhead to our shores, why they're actually threatening that, and while we're taking that threat seriously, our military people are telling us they could do it. In fact, we, you know, quickly did a test to see if we could shoot it down, and it was successful. My understanding is that that technology doesn't have a good rate of being successful, but now they've tweaked it, and so they had success yesterday. Thank God for that. But while that's kind of an issue, it's an issue we used to be focused on in this country, the press, what are they thinking about? Oh, fake news. Sean Spicer comes before them, and all they can talk about is fake news. It's just amazing to me. Or the Russians. We've got to get to the bottom of this. What's going on with the Russians and the collusion with the Trump administration, which we're going to talk a lot about today, as a matter of fact. On the last part of that, just Kevin sort of pivots to staff at the White House, and I just want you to know a couple of things. This Mike Dubke, who was the communications manager. So for many people, that's not a great loss. He was a Karl Rove connection, and that probably is not the best thing for a Trump administration, since Karl Rove was not a supporter, and in fact, not a supporter at all. So that's probably a good thing. There are some talks of doing some really good things and putting some people in place that actually might make a huge difference for this administration. So just stay tuned on that. While the press is totally preoccupied by the connection with Russia, and by the way, we should play clip 12 because this gives you an idea of just the amazing delusion going on in the press. And it seems, have you noticed, I've noticed this, that the press often has the same phrases in the mornings, like somebody sending out talking points, say this, use this phrase. Well, this is no exception. Let's listen to clip 12.
He wants to know what happened here. Let's get to the bottom of this.
This investigation needs to continue. They need to get to the bottom of it.
I think an independent commission is the most comprehensive way to get to the bottom of that.
That's the only way we're going to get to the bottom of this.
It shows clearly that he does not want to get to the bottom of it.
We need to get to the bottom of this.
It would be in everyone's best interest
to get to the bottom of this.
Maybe the Republicans don't really want to get to the bottom of this thing.
If anything, I think it's going to make them want to get to the bottom of this more.
A democracy can't function without trust. We've got to get to the bottom of this.
We have to get to the bottom of what the heck happened here.
Yeah. So don't think that's an accident. Don't think that's an accident. They didn't just all cleverly come up with some, worn phrase that they decided to use on the same day. That's coordinated. And so while they're fixated on this, we have serious problems. And of course, the Congress, the same thing. While this is happening, they're fixated on other things. In fact, let's listen to Mike Emanuel's report. The president is frustrated with the Senate and the use of the filibuster. And so I want you to hear Mike's report because this too is important. Here it is, clip six.
With Congress on recess, there are signs President Trump is losing patience waiting for major legislative accomplishments. The president tweeted this morning about changing the Senate rules to 51 votes to get health care and tax cuts approved fast and easy.
The frustration that he's had with the pace of some of the legislation and some of the obstructionist tactics that Democrats have employed, whether it's his cabinet nominees or other pieces of legislation, has been well documented.
The problem is the Senate has been looking to repeal and replace Obamacare and do major tax reform through budget reconciliation, which would allow them to be passed with 51 votes. So far, there isn't consensus among Republicans on those major issues. And Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has ruled out changing Senate rules for legislation.
There's not a single senator in the majority who thinks we ought to change the legislative filibuster. Not one.
Today, a key House Republican insisted the agenda is not stalled.
Senates have to get off their hind ends and start finding a compromise on health care so they can match us in the House. If that happens, then we're able to use the revenue from Obamacare to move our tax dials down and get actually tax reform. So it's happening, but it's happening relatively slowly.
You know, this is just unbelievable, really. This is a case where leadership in the Senate and the House are so bogged down with their own concerns that they can't see the big picture. President Trump is right as far as I'm concerned. This archaic rule of the Senate that says that you have to vote, you have to say to the senators, hey, do you guys want to vote on health care? Let's vote on whether you want to vote on health care. All right, all those in favor. And you have to get 60 votes in order then to next say, all those in favor of this health care plan say aye. You have to have 60 votes in order to get to the vote. Now, the vote doesn't take 60. It just takes a majority to pass the thing, whether it's health care or whatever. But you have to have 60 votes to say, yeah, we want to vote on that. It's a rule that Mr. McConnell loves. He dotes on this rule. And I'll tell you why. Because if and when, and based on what's happening now in the Senate, when he becomes minority leader again and not majority leader, that means he has power. If he has the filibuster, he can wield power. If he doesn't have the filibuster, he has no power. So he's thinking about his own power base, his own ability to wield authority. He's not thinking that this might be the last go-around. This actually might be the last chance that people who love this country have to pull it back from disaster. He's not thinking about that. He's thinking about his next time around in that seat when he might be minority leader and he still wants to have the power. I want you to hear this interaction between this is not between them. This is a montage of Sean Spicer and Mitch McConnell because Mitch McConnell goes further on it. Sean's asked to respond to the president's tweet. Oh, let's listen to it as we go out here. Cut 11.
Then. Concerns that he's had with the pace of the Senate has been longstanding. Obviously, the use of the filibuster and the rules of the Senate are ultimately up to Senator McConnell. This president was elected to get things done, and he wants to see things move through the House and the Senate, especially when you've got a majority of support and people to stop playing games.
There's not a single senator in the majority who thinks we ought to change the legislative filibuster. Not one.
Just to follow up on the earlier questions, are you committing that under your leadership you will never remove the legislative filibuster?
Correct.
Yeah, I'll never remove it, according to Mitch McConnell. All right. So you see where their priorities are, and you see why it's a perfect storm. It's a troubled storm, and so we'll continue to cover it. Coming up next, a former chief officer of the CIA will be joining us about all these leaks, so don't go away. Sandy Rios in the morning.
You're listening to A Decency Minute, an outreach broadcast of the American Decency Association based in Fremont, Michigan. I'm Bill Johnson. What we watch does impact. David R. Maines, then a radio broadcaster with a Chapel of the Air, shared this account years ago. It goes something like this. When David Maines would walk to his ministry headquarters in downtown Chicago, a young man who walked with him asked, "David, I see every time we walk by the adult bookstore arcade, you look the other way. Why do you do that?" David's answer, quoting, "I've learned not to give ground to Satan. Not allowing pornography into my eyes keeps my thought life free from Satan's jaded influence," unquote. David's words helped me. I hope it will help you too. Pure religion is to keep yourself unspotted from the world. This is A Decency Minute. Find us at americandecency.org. I'm Bill Johnson.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Pro-abortion analysts at the University of California, San Francisco examined data of 500 Utah women who were subject to a 72-hour waiting period before they could have an abortion. The bias researcher said the law burdened women with financial costs and legal hassles. But a follow-up with 300 of the women revealed the waiting period did persuade some women to change their minds about the abortion. To date, I've had about a dozen surgeries, and except for one which was an emergency, I waited far longer than 72 hours to have the procedures, and I was fully informed of their possible ramifications. Abortion's a surgical procedure that kills the mother's unborn baby. She can't have a do-over, so a waiting period is a protection for them.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Blake Bramlett. I graduated in May of 2016, and I graduated with a degree in interdisciplinary studies, focusing in psychology and missions. The professors here at TMU have really impacted my life in more than one way. In the classroom, of course, but really honestly, what makes the experience at Truett better is that they're mentors to us.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
A group of children from South Orange Middle School in New Jersey refused to have their picture taken with House Speaker Paul Ryan. Apparently, the school is liberal, and one of the kids told the local newspaper he hates Speaker Ryan, a 13-year-old. Another said he could not be photographed with someone who wants to destroy public education and leave 23 million people without health care. Sounds like the school's been so busy indoctrinating the little munchkins, they forgot to teach them good manners. It's a far cry from the previous administration, when school directed children to sing praise songs to President Obama. There was a time in our not-so-distant past when children were seen, not heard, and that policy was reinforced with a paddle, or in some cases, a hickory switch. But oh, how times have changed, America. I'm Todd Stearns.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
A source who has spoken to presidential advisor Jared Kushner tells Fox News that the December meeting at Trump Tower with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn focused on Syria and Russia's contention that the Obama administration policy was deeply flawed. As part of his transition role engaging with foreign delegations, the source said Kushner wanted to do a call between Russian generals on the ground in Syria and Flynn to further understand their complaints. According to the source, Kushner said it was the Russians who raised the issue of using a secure line for the call, emphasizing it was a one-off for a conversation about Syria and not a permanent back channel as alleged in media reports. The White House spokesman was pressed on the issue.
How is it that it's appropriate for someone who is a private citizen, not sworn in as an official of the U.S. government, to conduct any kind of negotiation or diplomacy with a foreign official.
Again, I would just refer you to both the comments that, that Secretary Kelly, General McMaster have said about how they can be an important tool in diplomacy.
Based on intercepted Russian communications, anonymous sources told the Washington Post, which broke the story, that Kushner wanted to set up a back channel using Russian diplomatic facilities to apparently make them more difficult to track. Kushner's lawyer said he is willing to share what he knows with Congress. The Post also reported the Russians have embellished stories in the past to sow confusion because they know their communications are monitored. But unnamed officials told the paper it was unclear how the Russian ambassador would have benefited.
All right, that's Catherine Herridge, her familiar voice on Special Report last night. Here's the thing. The Washington Post is refusing to hand over that anonymous letter by that anonymous source. The Daily Caller is doing an investigation on that. So nobody knows anything about that, the context, and it is true that there was a time when major newspapers who were trusted did not have such flimsy sourcing for their stories. So many people, including Lindsey Graham, think that this story is absolutely baseless. But whether it is or it is not, we certainly know that the reporter is reporting things we can't be sure of. And by the way, could I say that a year after this whole, almost a year, I think it'll be July, it's actually been longer than that because I told you Jay Johnson was the first person who started talking about the Russians interfering in our elections, and that was January of 2016. But when they actually started linking it to the Trump campaign, it was July of 2016. So it's been almost a year, and they have nothing. They have found nothing. They just keep talking. And I want to play this last clip from Catherine Herridge, this because I think this is really interesting. Let's listen.
The testimony of Carter Page, an informal foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, has been postponed indefinitely from its scheduled date of June 7th. Page, who is at the center of the anti-Trump dossier, continues to deny he was Moscow's point of contact.
There is no basis. I'm a loyal American. And I served my country in the military.
In a letter to the House Intelligence Committee, Page wrote, "The urgency of delivering truthful facts really does matter, and this exigent necessity has only seemed to grow in recent days."
A source familiar with the congressional matter said Page's testimony was put off at the request of committee Democrats. A spokesman for the ranking member, Adam Schiff, had no comment for our reporting. And since we've been on the air, the Associated Press is now reporting that the former National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, will provide records under subpoena to the Senate Intelligence Committee. As you recall, his lawyer had said previously that he would not cooperate, citing his Fifth Amendment protections, Brett.
Before I even introduce our guests, I want to tell you that one of the best stories I've read this morning comes out of the Washington Times. It's written by, I'm not sure it's written by, but it's a really, it kind of traces this story and gives a lot of interesting information relevant that I'm not going to be able to get to this morning. Carter Page, for instance, low-level advisor, kind of in name only to the president. He never even met with Donald Trump during the campaign face-to-face. And they are accusing him of being the leaker. He doesn't even know. It's out of that fake dossier I have been telling you about over and over and over again. Carter Page was eager to testify before Congress. And now the Democrats on the committee, as Catherine just reported, will not let him testify. We're not sure he'll ever testify. So that should speak volumes. All right, I'll be quiet because I want to hear our next guest. Brad Johnson, I'm delighted to report, is joining us this morning. He's the editor-in-chief of the Institute for Security Through Intelligence, but he's a former career senior operations officer and chief of station with the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Operations. He knows what he's talking about, and I'm delighted that he's with us this morning. Brad, thank you for joining us.
Sandy, it's such a pleasure, and thank you for having me, and it's a great pleasure to be with you on American Family Radio.
You know, this is a very confusing time, and you can explain a lot of these things. We have 17 different intelligence agencies. That in itself is kind of that happened under George Bush, didn't it? Where the intelligence agencies kind of burgeoned into more than they should have been?
Absolutely, yeah, that's correct. And it was following 9/11, it's kind of a typical government response. It's when there's an emergency of some kind, the response is do something. And Homeland Security was created, and the reorganization of intelligence, and how the more layers of bureaucracy was the result. It's an unfortunate thing where, in today's society, having a bureaucratic response is shown as doing something versus actually reacting and trying to fix the problem. There's a disconnect now within government circles between solving the problem and showing that you've done something. Those two things are no longer linked the way that traditionally they should and have been.
You know, one of the biggest complaints when they did investigations into 9/11 was that so-called wall, firewall, set up between intelligence agencies where they didn't share what they needed to share. And you and I both know that that was instituted actually by a Democrat. That was a piece of legislation. They didn't do that voluntarily. They were forced to build that firewall so that they could not share intelligence. And now we have the opposite. We have what? We don't have care taken, do we? Are they sharing like they should be? What's the breakdown, Brad?
Yeah, that is. You've also put your finger on another very serious problem. And just, you know, anecdotally, I can kind of demonstrate some of the problems that come up. Following 9/11 at the agency, one of the things that was instituted was basically all counterterrorism all the time, which is fine. But what happened as a result is other things went by the wayside. And just to say, human smuggling is one of those things where they kidnap women and children and sell them off into the slave sex trade, that sort of stuff. But human smuggling is a very large issue, including many other things, but that's one of the most disgusting components of it. And as a result, the agency just stops working on those sorts of things to concentrate on terrorism. And even myself personally, after I retired, had a great deal of information on it that I couldn't do anything with and went to the FBI and said, hey, let me give you all this stuff. Let me put you in contact with people. Go get them, you know, and a lot of this comes back into the United States. These problems carry over here as well as internationally with transnational criminal groups and so on, and they couldn't touch it. Couldn't touch it. And it was because of a retired CIA guy trying to give information to the FBI, and they were unable to do anything with it. So here we have this information now. It's dated and no, but of active stuff where we could have really took a chunk of human smuggling, and nobody was able to do anything with it, not the CIA, not the FBI, and it was because of this firewall that was created. And that goes up and down at every level and a lot of problems. And let me say, particularly at the working level, I've worked for years overseas with the FBI and their legal attaché offices. That's the FBI office when it's overseas in an embassy. Those are good guys. They all want to do the job and work well together and so on, which was same with us at the working level with the military, with the FBI. There's not a lot of problems. Everybody's willing to work together to make progress, but it's at the upper levels, when you get to the high levels of bureaucracy, that you have the rice bowl issues and these political decisions that are made, and they won't let us go out and we could do. I mean, just the drug trade, slave trade, counterterrorism, if the working people did you go do it, or you'd be way ahead in this world.
There was really an interesting story that came to my attention. I don't even, honestly, Brad, I don't know how, I don't think this is very widely known. I'm sure you know it, but I want to ask you about it. My understanding is that, I believe it was James Clapper who initiated setting up a kind of cloud for the 17 intelligence agencies to upload all their information to this cloud. And the server, or whatever the words are, whoever was going to provide that cloud, they ended up awarding that contract to Jeff Bezos and Jeff Bezos, who hates Trump, Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, who has become the most carelessly sourced provider of information in this whole alleged Russian scandal. And allegedly now this cloud is hosting all this information and it's easily accessible by the 17 agencies. What do you know about that? And does that make any kind of sense to you in terms of making sure that our information is secured?
Yeah, Tuffy, I have very little, direct knowledge of how that system was set up. So I can't speak to, where that information resides, where the cloud actually sits and so on. I mean, I can make some guesses, but I won't. The concept is fine. I mean, being able to share information is one of the issues, and the information that's traditionally supposed to go into a cloud like that are the intelligence reports, the IRs, which a lot of people produce intelligence out of the 17 agencies, and it's of various types, the CIA probably being the lead organization along with FBI, who produces a lot of that sort of information. And so having access to it, particularly for the analysts involved, where they can draw from that as one of their all-source resources, conceptually it makes good sense, but problem is then, you know, what goes into it, what doesn't go into it, and who decides and all of that sort of stuff. And then you have a breakdown of the, what's ORCON, the originator-controlled aspect of the information. Once it goes into that database, then you tend to lose that control. So it's one of those things, then, on the backside of it, you control who has access and how do you document that access so that we have the leaks that we have today. And I think you've got a very good feel for a lot of the issues that are out there. And this is one of the things where some of the leaks, I think, are coming from, because you have this widespread access out of 17 agencies and so on, and that the back end of it where you control who has access and how do you control and document that access and who's reading what and all that sort of stuff is just so difficult. And just silly little things that come up that nobody would have thought of in advance, like many times now in private sector, people have little fobs that they use that generates a random key that they use to then get into the system, and that documents within the system who's getting in there. For the government use, you can't take those because they have a built-in memory. You can't take those into the secure areas. So what works in private sector is just cannot be used in the intelligence world, because you're not supposed to be taking electronic memory devices into controlled areas where you have access to the classified information. So it's an extremely complex thing where conceptually it's a great idea, but in practicality it's just created so many unintended consequences. It's very unwieldy.
Yeah, and it does make, I mean, I guess what I'm inferring, I'll just say what I'm inferring, is if it's going to be on a cloud, and if it's going to be managed by a company owned by an enemy of the president, who owns a news outlet, who is actually printing things that cannot be verified, that have to do with national security information and leaks and unmasking of names, is it possible, that unfriendly people might have access to that information in the cloud?
Well, yeah, by unfriendly, what we're talking about here is people who are unfriendly to the president, and there's absolute proof of that coming out every day. I mean, the leaks that have been going on, just constant dribble of leaks, and a lot of that information is based on classified information. Just for example, what was the news item 2 weeks ago where President Trump was meeting with the Russians and was discussing a piece of intelligence with them, where the originators of the information were the Israelis, about a Syrian who was plotting to probably blow up a civilian commercial craft, which is 100% appropriate. That's exactly the type of intelligence sharing that goes on. Three times there were leaks based on that, including that the organization was the Israelis. The leaker is the one that got those secrets out to the public, not the president. The president's actions were perfectly acceptable, but when he wrote that up, this information went into the different systems and probably went into that cloud, and then somebody picked that up and said, hey, we can spin this to damage the president. So, I mean, there's absolute conclusive evidence that this is being done on a real-time, daily basis by people who have access to classified information, whose goal in life is not to protect the interests of the United States, but whose goal is to damage the president of the United States. So you have somebody who, I think, by any reasonable standard, is essentially a they have no moral compass that lets them know, hey, I mean, even though I hate the president, to damage the United States is still wrong, and the priority is political, which is again the amorality aspect of it, is that they view that as more important than protecting the interests of the United States. So it's, yeah, absolutely, 100% incontrovertible proof that is taking place on a daily basis. And I think it's a widespread number of people and a reasonably organized basis, too. It's a drumbeat. It's not they all come out together. They're just dribbled one after the other.
My guest is Brad Johnson. Again, he's a career senior operations officer and former chief of station with the Central Intelligence Agency, serving overseas for a number of years in various capacities. And when we return, Brad, I just want to ask you I've got so many things to ask you, but I'd love to know how you think it was that the intelligence, members of the intelligence community began to be so hostile to really, I think, things that are congruous with American patriotism, Why they view that as part of their enemy, people that would propose policies that actually could help America. When did they become enemies of the state? And where did the deep state come from? How big is it? Can we actually stop it? And little questions like that. My guest is Brad Johnson, and we'll come back with that conversation after this. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. A study by St. Mary's University, Twickenham, London, has found the UK's non-religious population is now bigger than its combined Christian one. The study shows for every new convert to Christianity in the UK, 26 Christians abandon the faith. This is what happens when macroevolutionary theory, moral relativism, postmodernism, and secular humanism dominate a society. We can expect no less in America unless we learn the lessons of Europe. Repent and turn to God. May the Lord revive the Great Commission in our nation.
Visit the Hamilton Corner on the podcast page at AFR.net. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
To sharpen the faith of Christians and to share the good news of Jesus Christ with those who don't know Him. That is the mission of the Christian Worldview Radio program. This is host David Wheaton inviting you to join us this Saturday morning at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, to pursue that mission as we discuss a compelling topic from a decidedly biblical perspective. The Christian Worldview, Saturday mornings at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, right here on AFR Talk.
Steve Tiber of 8 Days of Hope.
Our great country continues to get slammed by natural disasters, hurricanes and tornadoes, flooding. I mean, it's everywhere from Texas, South Carolina, to Georgia, Mississippi, all throughout the country, our country has suffered. Here's where you and I get a chance to be a glimpse of Jesus. It is so cool to meet a homeowner who has gone to no fault of their own. Their world has been turned upside down, and you get a chance to bless them. You know, we tarp roofs and do chainsaw work, and we gut homes that flooded right after disaster with our rapid response team. And then we also look to rebuild homes with 8 Days of Hope, like we've done 12 different areas of the country. 1,800 homes, $25 million of damage. People all the time say, man, you're good. Well, we're not that good, but He is great. Be a part of something unique. 8 Days of Hope.
Learn more at 8daysofhope.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Pentagon just successfully tested the nation's only missile defense system designed to destroy the kind of intercontinental ballistic missiles with which North Korea hopes soon to threaten us. That's the good news. The bad news is that the missile threats facing America are intensifying by the day, and not just from the psychopathic regime of North Korea's despot Kim Jong-un. Russian and Chinese nuclear forces are incorporating hypersonic and maneuvering warheads expressly for the purpose of defeating our limited anti-missile systems. Worse yet, it is a matter of time before the North Koreans, and for that matter, the Iranians, gain access to such technologies. Against such eventualities, Congress last year made it the law of the land that America field a robust defensive shield that can protect our country and its people against hypersonic and maneuvering weapons. We need it now. This is Frank Affney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
wants to know what happened here. Let's get to the bottom of this.
This investigation needs to continue. They need to get to the bottom of it.
I think an independent commission is the most comprehensive way to get to the bottom of that.
That's the only way we're going to get to the bottom of this.
It shows clearly that he does not want to get to the bottom of it.
We need to get to the bottom of this.
It would be in everyone's best interest to get to the bottom of this.
Maybe the Republicans don't really want to get to the bottom of this thing.
If anything, I think it's going to make them want to get to the bottom of this more.
A democracy can't function without trust. We've got to get to the bottom of this.
We have to get to the bottom of what the heck happened here.
Yeah, well, they got their memo this morning or yesterday, didn't they, on what they should say. We have to get to the bottom of this. Well, we have, I think, at least three committees, one in the Senate, one in the House. We've got now a special counsel. We've got all kinds of people in the FBI investigating, trying to get to the bottom of this. So perhaps we will. Of course, meanwhile, Carter Page is not going to be allowed to testify. He's at the center of this. He's one of the key targets of this so-called investigation by the FBI into some tie with Russia. And Carter's saying, I have no ties. What are you talking about? That dossier is ridiculous. Please let me testify. But the Democrats now have decided they don't want him to testify. I think that's fascinating. Okay, so a lot of this started through some sort of leaking. And as I understand it, John Brennan, the CIA director, who was a part of the Clinton apparatus to reelect Mrs. Clinton, a Clinton partisan, by the way, who'd voted for the Communist Party candidate in 1980, who was then CIA director under Barack Obama, attached this dossier, which was ridiculous if you read it. I have read parts of it. To a classified, highly classified briefing for President Obama and also for members of the House, knowing, it seems, that it would be leaked. And so that's, I think, where the leaking started. Brad Johnson maybe knows, probably, likely, better than I do. Again, a former chief of operations officer for the CIA, chief of station. Brad, thanks for joining us again. All right, so John Brennan, do you think was he the original leaker in this, if you had to guess?
You know, hard to say if he personally was the original leaker, but certainly he was the part of the impetus for the movement, and he surrounded himself with like-minded people who viewed it as, you know, again, as we were sort of speaking about before, he and the people around him viewed this as the political aspects of President Trump being elected are more important than defending the United States against the enemy, our enemies overseas. So if he personally didn't do it, he certainly was, you know, ultimately holds the responsibility for it in many ways, at least to some degree part of the leaking. And I would take this whole situation back to Jimmy Carter and the Church Commission and those sorts of things that initially essentially went on the attack against the CIA and fired thousands of people and so on, and then moved forward to President Clinton days where he then instituted a program government-wide to put in his own people and put them in and put very down into low levels political appointees that then were converted to staff positions and those sorts of things. And then President Obama, with former Director Brennan, had that perfect platform from which to build and finalize the process where they destroyed the capacity of the CIA to run operations and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't think there's anybody in the agency that really is, you know, anybody good is gone essentially now. And you've got a new director, Mike Pompeo, who would like to build the organization back and run operations and recently came out with a press report saying we're back in the business of stealing secrets, which John Brennan had said that the CIA no longer did in one of his interviews. But John Brennan destroyed the program, destroyed the capability, destroyed everything related to operations, which is to be out, you know, getting secrets and learning information that the United States needs for its own defense. So that whole thing was destroyed, and just giving the order to start doing it again, which Mike Pompeo has done, isn't going to be enough to turn it around. So you've got this large cadre of people that were brought in under Brennan that remained there with the new director. There have been very few changes. So some people were shuffled around, but that was it. And so these leaks are going to continue, and those people are there that believe that this is the thing to do. The crew that Brennan left in there are still there. So one of the questions you asked before the break was what can be done, and I'm not sure that anything can be done. I mean, it may be too late. Unless they're willing to actually grab the bull by the horns and clean house, It will not change. It will not change. It's going to continue as it has been in these early days of the president. You're going to see the same stuff play out over and over through the years until they recognize the fact that essentially we're in a political civil war, and they need to clean up and get people in that are willing to put the job first and the country first in politics at the bottom of the list. And until they're willing to recognize that truth, these leaks are just going to continue. It's just going to stay the way it is. Separate question from that, the operational capability of the CIA, it may be too late there. I think they've kind of destroyed it. It may be a thing where you want to move, create another agency, condense the 17 intelligence agencies down, but create a separate one to take over the operations, because you're seeing now the military trying to be involved and the CIA trying to be involved, and you've got all these separate players. Even State Department is trying to get involved in clandestine operations and things like that. I mean, what kind of world have we come to where just everybody does everything? I mean, it's insanity. It cannot work. It will only get people killed, and that's what we're seeing now, is people are getting killed as a result of this just disorganized mess.
Wow. All right. Well, there's so much to ask you. So let me be selective here. I would, you know, you just said it's a political war. I guess, Brad, I would say that's the most innocent explanation. You know, when you have I just don't understand, even given your explanation, how we got to a point where a CIA director could have voted for the communist candidate in 1980 when we were in full-out enemy status with the Soviet Union. Who were the Soviets, who were the Russians, who were the communists, fully known. How could a... I heard John Brennan, this has probably been a year ago, he was talking in front of a group, and I don't know if it was a group of people representing Black Lives Matter, but it was some black organization that's far to the left, and he was laughing with them and encouraging them to apply for positions in the CIA, because even if they had criminal records, whatever their background, don't worry. You know, I voted for the communist candidates in 1980. Don't worry about that. So wasn't there a time? You know, my husband is former FBI. I think he had to sort of swear loyalty to the United States, and I do not believe if he had ever voted for a member of the Communist Party, he would have been able to get into the FBI. Isn't that the case at the CIA?
Well, traditionally, certainly. I mean, and the oaths are very similar. I mean, you swear to uphold the Constitution and protect the United States, and you have hit precisely, again, one of the central key issues of why, in my opinion, the CIA is probably no longer viable as a clandestine organization that can go out and do operations in the world on a unilateral basis. And it's because of hiring practices and all those things you said. Well, from Brennan's perspective and from the perspective of that group of people that were brought in under former President Obama, political reliability and trustworthiness is the main qualification for being hired. So he goes to the extreme left-wing groups and hires from there. So that's who you see in the agency today. That was begun under President Clinton and now has been consolidated and completed under Obama. I mean, it's a long process. The people who are in charge there are Clinton people. And the people now, the rank and file, are the Obama people. And some of them were brought in, like Brennan, in the senior positions and so on. And to be a law-abiding, loyal citizen of the United States in today's government, and in the agency and so on, you're something of a pariah. And those people behind their backs are made fun of and so on. And those are the loyal citizens. Those are the only people left that we could actually build a program out of again. And they're just looked down upon, made fun of, not given good assignments, don't get promoted, all of that sort of stuff. I mean, they're not, it's not a straightforward situation. It's just behind the scenes, those people are just sidelined. And that's that. That's the whole process that you've seen been running consistently between Clinton and Obama, including the Bush years, where Bush did very little to turn it around. He just let it sort of slowly move along in the same direction. And so, as I said, it was consolidated under Brennan, and they view political loyalty as the most important aspect of being hired, where what you're laying out is the correct way. That's just not their view. That's that amorality that I keep referring to, because it's the leftist view, and leftists everywhere in the world are the same. I mean, they view political loyalty as, by far the most important aspect of selecting somebody for a position, and everything else is secondary. Where we look at it as, if you have intelligence decisions or economic decisions that need to be made, or in any other specialty, you pick somebody who's an expert in economics, or you pick somebody who's an expert in intelligence operations and those things, and put them in charge so that they'll run a good program. That's how we would all view it. And it's just a different perspective. They don't view that as important. They don't care if John Brennan knew how to run an intelligence operation. What they cared about is he was a loyal party member. And
Maybe literally. Yeah, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Hey Brad, exactly right. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask this important, and I know we won't have enough time, but here goes. The issue right now is whether Russia colluded with the Trump administration. That's the allegation. That's the mantra we hear morning to night ad nauseum. But the irony is that John Brennan initiated a six-year reset with Moscow. He was trying to play footsie. He wanted to get close to them. How do you, from your own perspective, as a former CIA who's used to thinking of the intricacies of issues, how do you see this whole accusation about Russia and the real connections with the left, including John Brennan, with Russia?
Well, the connections to the left are very real. The Democratic Party has always had a lot of connections back to many of the leftist parties around the world, including Cuba, to even today, and Russia, and many of the left-wing countries that are, in fact, enemies of the United States. And certainly, famously, Teddy Kennedy had a lot of relationship back. But those have always existed, even back in during the Central American War with Nicaragua and so on, during the Reagan years. Leftist congressmen had relations to these different countries and what are in fact enemy powers. So it's something that's gone on, particularly by the Democrats, for years and years and years, certainly decades. And to the Trump situation, what the Democrats are doing right now in the press and the politicians is they're taking everyday normal communications. We have official liaison relationships with Russia. We have diplomatic relationships with Russia. We have informal and business relationships with Russia. So they're taking all of those things that are part of a normal work day in Washington, D.C., they're pointing out all of those things and going, see, that's proof. So they're confusing what's normal relationships with Russia and claiming that there was some sort of cooperation taking place between the Trump campaign and Russia. And they're trying to bleed that over into as proof that there's some sort of collusion between Trump and the Russians. And of course, it's one of the most difficult things in the world. You know, when a story is completely made up, how do you battle that? I mean, how do you prove they're lying when it's just a made up story? And that's the issue that the Trump campaign or the Trump presidency is faced with. And again, I don't think they recognize the depth of the problem that they're facing politically here in the United States. And so they're actually doing very little to defend themselves, in my opinion, against these sorts of things. I'm not sure how easy that would be to do, but I'm not sure that they're making as much of an effort as they could. So it's very, very difficult situation. And so the problem, if you look back, it's the same problem we had in the Soviet Union. They would make up these outlandish things, and in their propaganda techniques and stuff, they openly said it. You know, you create enough smoke that everyone will assume there's fire beneath it, even when it's completely made up issue. And the United States was always faced with a problem of how to defend yourself against something that's a completely made up story for which there's no basis. I mean, to this day, Russian propaganda still overseas says that AIDS is a disease that was created by the U.S. military, and it escaped from their control and got out into the population. And still, there's a lot of people in the world that believe that today. And that type of propaganda goes on. When a country has drought, the Russians come in and say, oh, it's the Americans' fault because they're doing X, Y, Z. So it's just a worldwide constant drumbeat that, the Democrats and liberal press here has picked up and continue and play with, and they'll draw from international news and so on.
The irony is that they're using Russian propaganda techniques really against Trump and then weaving in Russia itself. It's just an amazing twist. Brad Johnson, we have to talk again. Editor-in-Chief of the Institute for Security Through Intelligence, and a great resource. And Brad, thank you so much for your time and for your service to this country. And God willing, we can turn this thing around. We're sure going to try.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I'm going to do everything I can. And Sandy, thank you so much again for having me. It's been such a great pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.